CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. And finally, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And this week's CFO Radio News has been published by CFO Magazine. Talking about growth, we are going to be meeting with somebody who whose business is helping companies succeed in the area of growth. And our news article follows that vein. Mid-sized companies see growth ahead, says CFO Magazine. Growth dominates the agendas of mid-sized companies, a new survey by Deloitte indicates. About 80% of respondents see their company's revenues and profits growing this year, 2011, and nearly 70% plan to hire, according to the survey of 527 top managers at U.S.-based firms with revenues between $50 million and $1 billion. That's great news if you are looking for employment, 70% plan to hire. But the economy and the economic uncertainty and weak market demand still continue to be top concerns among those executives. Few of those surveyed expect outsized growth in the economy as a whole, with most anticipating an increase in gross domestic product of 3.5% or less. The survey results show a great deal of optimism grounded with some level of caution, says Tom McGee, managing partner of Deloitte Growth Enterprise Services. Well, today we are joined by Stuart Johnson, partner in the Atlanta office of Barnes and Thornburg LLP. A little bit of background about Stuart before we start. Stuart Johnson is the managing partner of Barnes and Thornburg's Atlanta office, a member of the firm's management committee, the chairman of the firm's private equity practice group, and is a member of the firm's corporate department. He is a corporate and transactional lawyer and has assisted clients with mergers and acquisitions, joint ventures, corporate financing transactions, and general business matters in a variety of industries, including telecommunications, manufacturing, plastics, home building, business services, chemicals, logistics, food service, life sciences, medical device, and healthcare. Stuart has been authored and quoted in numerous articles relating to merger and acquisition trends and activities, particularly those related to growth-oriented businesses and private equity or PE transactions, as we call them. He's organized and participated in business growth and expansion programs sponsored by several university and educational institutions, and he's actively involved with the Association for Corporate Growth and the Premier Global Association for professionals involved in that corporate growth organization. He's currently a member of ACG's Global Board of Directors, was the chairman of ACG's National Conference Into Growth in May 2010, and is one of the founders of the ACG Atlanta Capital Connection, which, by the way, is the largest private equity conference in the Southeast United States. Well, Stuart, I could go on. Your bio has an awful lot of details in it. I know that you received your BA with distinction from University of Virginia, and you've got an MA in economics from Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. You also earned your JD from the University of Virginia, and you were named to the Order of the COIF. I'm not sure if I pronounced that quaff, but you certainly are able to practice law in the state of Georgia. So welcome to the radio show, Stuart.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Stuart, we're going to dig straight into detail. You are an M&A guy through and through, and you've helped many, many companies go through transactions. You are, in fact, our first guest who is from the legal profession, so consider yourself in an elite status on CFO Radio. Tell us a little bit as we start as to what got you into this and why this is your passion.
I went to I went to law school and actually from a business background. I was working as a business consultant before going to school, and frankly, I've always wanted to be a business lawyer because it's the closest thing to being a business person in the legal profession. And what I love about what I do, and what I love about helping people as I do on a regular basis, is I get to learn a whole lot about different businesses and the dynamics behind them all, and then help people execute on strategic initiatives, either to grow or to realize value within an asset that's on their personal balance sheet. And it's just a lot of fun and frankly very satisfying.
What is it? Is it the excitement of the deal?
It's learning about the excitement of the deal is obviously there. It's always an interesting dynamic as you're moving forward and working as a part of a team to accomplish a goal. The other part, frankly, is the excitement of the vision of the entrepreneurs and the business people that we work with. There are some very smart people who have done very, very creative things. And I like to say that to me, it's amazing how many ways people can create value for themselves and for their shareholders and their constituency groups. And, you know, we get to learn about that sort of throughout the process.
So let's maybe start at the beginning. How does one of these transactions come about? How does your firm, how are you introduced to the process? And at what stage of the process typically are you introduced to that transaction?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the transaction itself, and then we'll talk about sort of how we as lawyers, and then as sort of the service professionals involved get engaged. But how does a mergers and acquisitions and M&A transaction come about in the first instance? That really depends upon which side of the spectrum you're on. If you are a seller, how a transaction potentially comes about is that there's a recognition within your business and your activity that indicates that you have to be something different than what you are, right? Either you need to be bigger, right? You've made a personal decision that you're ready to, you know, sort of change the speed at which you're operating your life, or other things of that sort. So there's a recognition of a need for a change, and an M&A transaction is a way to implement that change. If you're a buyer, you know, the recognition is that buyers of companies can grow in two different ways. They can grow organically through sort of traditional means, or they can grow through acquisition. And so it's sort of a build or buy kind of an analysis. And buyers of M&A of other companies have made a determination that to execute on their growth plans, it's better for them to buy in certain circumstances than to attempt to grow. And there are all kinds of dynamics behind that. So those are the determinations on the seller and the buyer side of the equation. How do we get involved? Lawyers and other professionals involved in M&A transactions. If a company has made a determination that they need to engage in an M&A transaction, that's one entry point for professionals like myself. And once they've made that determination, they need to have people to help them through that process. And the biggest issue with a M&A transaction is execution risk. Keeping your eye on the ball and making sure the primary business continues to operate in an effective, efficient, and profitable manner during the course of the transaction, but at the same time, optimizing the opportunity for success in the transaction. I say to people all the time that my job as an M&A lawyer is to minimize transaction risk. You know, my job is to highlight the issues that that a buyer or a seller needs to focus on, help address those issues, and get the deal done. That's my primary job.
So the risk there being the fact that a lot of people could invest a lot of time and the deal not go ahead.
Yes. Or if you're on the seller side, you know, a risk that tends to be seen on a regular basis if the seller is not careful is that the seller considers the deal done before it actually is. I have a great painting in my office that was done by Frederick Remington, and it shows a cowboy, and he's looking over the edge of a cliff, and he's scratching his head, and just outside of his reach, over the edge of the cliff, is an elk that he has shot, and the caption on this painting is "Meat's not meat until it's in the pan." And I tend to give a copy of this picture to clients of mine as we go through the deal process, because it's the same thing for a transaction. You can't count on meat being in the pan until you've actually got it in your hand. So particularly as we represent sellers, you have to continually remind them that the deal isn't done until the funds have been wired into their account. And so you have to continually focus and continually plan for something happening that doesn't bring it to fruition. And our job is to obviously do everything we can to bring it to fruition, but also make sure that the client is fully prepared and is not harmed if it doesn't get there.
So how do you help a company prepare? And in fact, as we go down that path, let's step back a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about the sorts of companies that you help, the size, the industry. Give us a little bit more background, if you can, on Barnes and Thornburg.
Right. Well, so we as a firm, Barnes and Thornburg has been here in Atlanta for a little over 2 years now. We are a national law firm now with 12 offices and 550 lawyers. Here in Atlanta, we have just this week actually moved into new office space to accommodate growth. We started here with two lawyers. We now have 20, and we are growing. Our market, we represent middle market businesses, and we are a full service firm in representing those types of businesses. Middle market being defined fairly broadly, but as we look at the market in a geography like Atlanta, most of the companies here are middle market companies. We provide legal services in all arenas for those companies on a full service basis. My personal practice, and this fits with what we do as a law firm, really is industry agnostic. As you indicated as we started this conversation, I've been involved in transactions in a variety of different industries. The commonality of the clients that I tend to work with, and frankly that we as a law firm tend to work with, is that they are clients that are undertaking that are engaged in strategic activity. They're growing, they're buying, they're selling, they're entering into joint ventures, they're doing fairly sophisticated things to grow enterprise value for themselves and their constituency groups. You know, and our job is to help them with that.
So how does it start? We've got the company that's come to you. We've talked about the buyer side, the seller side. What is your procedure or process from that stage on?
Well, we tend to work as a part of a team. So let's talk about a transaction, you know, sort of a potential merger and acquisition transaction. What tends to happen is that a business makes a strategic decision to buy or to sell. Following along the conversation we had earlier, a seller decides it makes sense for them to engage in a sale transaction. A buyer decides it would be better for them to buy than to build. They would be able to accomplish their purposes more appropriately that way. Once that decision is made, then the team gets assembled, and frankly, at times, the team participates in helping to make that decision. I do that a lot. I spend a lot of time with clients as they decide strategically what they need to do. Once that happens, then it's a determination as to how to engage in a process, and sometimes it may be reaching out on a very limited basis to potential buyers. Sometimes it may be responding to offers that have come in from sort of unsolicited offers from potential acquirers if we're on the sale side. Sometimes it may be on the buy side, engaging someone to help in identifying potential acquisition targets and then executing on that.
And then from that stage on, due diligence and so forth, do you help the company to bring in additional advisors to help with valuation and so forth?
Oh, absolutely.
And would that be typically a CPA firm or a different entity?
Well, it depends. The CPA firms are clearly a valued part of the overall transactional team. Many firms, and there are a lot of very good ones here in Atlanta, as I know you know, many firms have sort of the valuation competency. The areas that tend to be focused on as you engage in a transaction and where the most amount of time is spent is financial diligence and validation, and legal diligence, financial diligence and validation, legal diligence and validation, and then financing issues and the interaction between various financing sources that may be present. The accountants are obviously the accountants and the investment bankers are the folks that are the most helpful on the financial diligence and validation area of focus. The lawyers, our core competency obviously is the legal diligence and validation part of a transaction, and then the documentation part and negotiation part of a transaction, and then the investment bankers and in many cases the financial people within the buying company are sort of on point on the financing aspects of an overall transaction. So those are sort of the core competency areas and the core areas of focus in a deal, and then the other part obviously is the actual documentation and the negotiation of the specific terms and conditions of a transaction.
And the documentation, is that primarily to support a valuation and a legal agreement, or is it procedural or some other nature?
Documentation in an M&A transaction is a matter of identifying and clarifying rights and responsibilities and priorities as between constituency groups. What I mean by that is there are a variety of claims on the business, right? Claims being equity claims or debt claims or contract claims or things of that sort. And so the documentation clarifies how all those fit together. And then in the actual transaction itself, the primary purpose of the purchase purchase document is to allocate risk between the buyer and the seller, right? To validate what the price is and to say who's responsible for what if something comes up that's different than what was initially represented as being the state of the business that's being sold or bought.
So let me just ask a particular question, because I'm somewhat intrigued by this. What is the most unusual transaction that you've had? Because we are talking primarily about corporations, companies, legal entities that are being bought. But in the realm of intellectual property, what is the most unusual transaction that you've helped to be acquired?
Gosh, that's a great question. The most unusual transaction that I've been involved in, I would have to say that it was I represented a proprietary school, this is a for-profit educational institution in a sale transaction a number of years ago, and I would say that's probably it was an unusual circumstance because of there were several dynamics that played there, and they all interacted to create sort of an interesting overall transaction. There was a seller and buyer dynamic, which is always present. The seller was a personality, I think I'll leave it at that. The buyer was an equal personality, so the chemistry between the seller and the buyer were very it required more than just traditional legal acumen to help navigate that.
So you were part marriage counselor and psychologist all in one.
Well,
right?
It was all of the above, right? And that tends to be that's not an unusual dynamic. It just happened to be more prevalent in that particular transaction than in the normal one.
You know, I always find it's interesting that both parties come to the table because they want to do the deal, and yet there frequently is animosity, perhaps created from a perspective of fear and the unknown and uncertainty. But there does tend to be a lot of anguish at the table when this is a transaction that everybody at the table wants to do.
Yeah, part of the lawyer's role, you know, the advisor's role in that kind of circumstance is to keep people focused on the ball. What I tend to find on a regular basis is that, and I won't say people get very emotional as you go through a process, particularly sellers who it's not normal for them to engage in a strategic transaction, and things are said in the process that they react to very emotionally as opposed to logically. And part of the transactional advisor's job there is to bring everything back into context and to help people understand that it's not that you have to understand what the ultimate goal is. So that the transaction I was describing as an example had a lot of those dynamics. The seller who I represented had a sense of self-worth that was tied up with this particular business. The buyer proposed certain terms of this transaction. In this case, it was an employment terms that the seller didn't feel like reflected his value to the business, and so he reacted very emotionally to that. And our job there was to say, wait a minute, you know, think about this from an overall perspective. Here's how much you're being paid for this business on an overall basis, and yes, you know, you may be paid a little bit less for your employment activities than you think you deserve, but the overall transaction is a very good one for you. So keep it all in context. And so that's a dynamic you see regularly.
Sure. And What is the are there any legal documents that are filed in terms of, and I, clearly I know the answer to that is, but perhaps explain to us the procedure of filing and what one could expect. I mean, for example, how long does it take to go through this process of the acquisition and the sale?
It all depends. I mean, that's a great question, and the answer is it can be fast and it can be slow. I have one client war story that I love to tell, representing a seller who was selling to a private equity firm. And it was important for this particular seller to be done with this transaction within 45 days of the date that we signed a term sheet. You know, and frankly, the reason for that being important to him is not important. The fact that he laid it as a condition to his agreeing to a transaction with the seller was important, and we closed that transaction within 45 days. The advisors to the buyer had to work really well. All of us had to work really hard. The advisors to the buyer had to be reminded of this time frame on a continual basis through the transaction, but we were able to accomplish it in that time frame. That tends to be on the fast side. More typically, it's, you know, 3 to 4 months. It's 60 to 90 to 120 days from the date of signing a term sheet to a closing, and that's just because there tend to be a variety of things involved in the process.
But even still, it's not a year or two or three.
It can be, but if a seller has made a decision to sell and a buyer has made a decision to buy, and they sign a term sheet that's agreed on, you should be able to get to a conclusion within the kind of time frame I'm describing to you.
So let's say that I have a company and I'm looking to sell it. Are there brokers that you go to that act as an agent or a registrant? I don't perhaps even know the terminology to use, that can go promote, hey, I've got this great company over here. It's for sale.
Well, that's a... what you're describing is the role of an investment banker. An investment banker, their primary role in the mergers and acquisitions world is to help companies that wish to sell or companies that wish to buy identify buyers or sellers appropriately. And they do a great job in doing that, and that's what their role is. They will put together if they're representing a company that is selling. You know, a good investment banker will put together a presentation about that business, and then systematically identify potential buyers and present that company to these potential buyers. And you know, hopefully the end result of all of that will be one or more buyers who are very interested and present an acquisition proposal, and then the transaction closes.
Now, is that always the case even for, let's say, a large corporation buying the mom-and-pop type stores or companies?
In that situation, larger corporations may have their own internal process for identifying potential acquisitions. That's called a corporate development function within a larger business, and many companies have that internally. So they, as a regular part of their business operations, they would be looking for entities that would make sense to buy instead of build.
So maybe a Coca-Cola or a GE or one of the larger firms maybe would actually have their own internal audit department. In fact, very often they are staffed with tens, if not more, of a couple of dozen of people that are looking for these M&A transactions.
Absolutely.
So that being said, then we come to the oil and the grease part of it. You're trying to get the engine to turn. Are there any particular activities that you see companies that are making mistakes as they go through this process? Any learning that can you can share with our audience?
Yeah, I think there are probably and I don't have my, you know, the five lessons in front of me right now, but there are some core areas of sort of paying attention as you go through a process. And this tends to be applicable to someone who is on the sell side. Buyers tend to be, if they are regular buyers, the companies that we were mentioning earlier, you know, they have a pretty systematic way of looking for acquisitions and then executing on acquisitions. Middle market companies that are sellers tend not to sell that often. You know, so there are some areas where sellers have to really pay attention, and I've mentioned one of them earlier, and that is a seller going into a transaction should operate their business as they are in a transaction process as if the transaction will not close. In other words, pay attention to your plumbing, right? Pay attention to the operation of the business. Don't take your eye off the ball of the decisions that you would otherwise make in regular operation of your business because you're engaged in a sale transaction. You can never count on it happening, and you need to make sure that you continue to operate your business. The other thing that we see often is, and this is more of a planning for engaging in a transaction at some point in the future, get your documents and get your financial records in an appropriate shape. If you're a privately held business, as an example, don't put your race car on the balance sheet, right? Keep your airplane someplace else. Make sure that you operate your business as a business and your personal activities as personal activities. More times than not, in businesses that are closely held, those things tend to be intertwined a little more than they need to be, and it creates a problem as you go through an acquisition process.
And so part of the process is to unwind that.
Right.
Or dissect it, if you will.
Right.
So that's also part of the process. And then are there any particular elements that, I mean, would you say there's a top one, two, three that absolutely these are the things that are critical that you must do? Maybe both from the buyer and the seller perspective.
Well, the critical items on the sell side include what I've just talked about. I would say that keep your eye on the ball, don't count the meat before it's in the pan is clearly item one, and perhaps item two on the sell side of the equation. Keep your financial get your financial house in order is clearly an item, is an important item for you. On the buy side, you know, probably the most important item is be disciplined about what you're looking for, and don't fall in love with a business. You know, all of us have personal experience, I would imagine, with sort of getting enamored with something or someone, right? And perhaps at some point in the future, realizing that that something or someone isn't exactly what you had expected it to be, right? Well, it happens in the business context too, and the biggest discipline and the most successful acquirers in the M&A space are folks who have objective criteria for looking for a potential acquisition and stick to those objective criteria, you know, sort of regardless of the emotion or the subjective things that come up in the process. And that's how you separate very successful acquisition strategies from ones that may be less successful.
So be prepared to walk from the table.
Yes.
Kind of reminds me of the Thomas Crown affair where the acquisition, the deal's just gone ahead, and the one side of the table said, you know, I would have paid X tens of millions more. And the other side of the table said, well, yeah, it actually wasn't worth as much as you actually paid. And so the smile quickly came off his face, huh?
Right.
So what is your role post the deal? do you exit and you're done, or is the attorney's role still a continuation?
Well, there are two answers to that. You know, for the from a transactional perspective, right? As a mergers and acquisitions role tends to be finished fairly quickly after a transaction is done. There's obviously some cleanup things that have to happen, but you know, the engagement that a lawyer would have to help a client consummate a merger and acquisition transaction, you know, has a start point and has an end point. However, our role and our firm's role tends to be with clients broader than just transactionally based. I consider myself, and hopefully my clients would consider me, a counselor, right, who works with them on a regular basis throughout their business life cycle. And so what that would mean is, even though one of the things that I would do for a client would be a transaction that would have a start date and an end date, I tend to be involved much longer than that, because that's only one thing that they do in their business life cycle, and there are many other things that happen after that. So that's a long answer, and perhaps a little different than the question that you asked, but that's how my relationships with my clients and our firm's relationships with our clients tend to work. We have long-term relationships that have many aspects to them, one of those aspects being the kinds of strategic transactional activity that we've been talking about.
Sure. And I think that is absolutely key. One of the components that my firm sees as we are in this realm, and we are not an attorney's firm, we're a little bit of a different part of the deal. We often provide the financial expertise to be able to support the transactions that you're describing. But in that regard, very often what we see is that a company may go to making certain mistakes. The smaller the company looking for that, what they would call an M&A transaction, or what may be an investor for their firm, very often they do not go with FINRA-registered brokers, and deals can fall apart for a variety of reasons. But I certainly see a lot of that activities done. I mean, obviously, if you're dealing with a well-fledged investment banking firm, they have all of the appropriate credibilities at the table. But it is a highly regulated industry.
Absolutely.
And my sense would be that certainly on the legal side, you're wanting to make sure that all that, the regulation side of the legal side of it, is all checked and balanced.
Yeah, that's a good sense. Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you one final question. I'm afraid we're getting to the end of the show, Stuart, and this has been very unique. We've not had the topic of M&A transactions from the side of the attorneys on the show, so this has been fabulous. But I'm going to ask you one more question. Typically, we would ask, what is your CFO tip of the month? Because our guests are going to be CFOs. But I'd like for you to answer that question in terms of the seat that you sit on. What would be your tip that you would give to CFOs in the light of what you see in your business profession?
Well, let's talk about it in thank you for asking that question, and I spend a lot of time interacting with CFOs, so hopefully my answer would be helpful as your listeners hear this program, and so let's talk about it in the context of a strategic transactional activity like we've been talking about. My tip to a CFO who's finding themselves in that seat, right, that involved in a transaction with their enterprise, either selling or buying, is make sure you get help in doing that, and make sure that your bandwidth is not stretched as you go through the process. I've seen more circumstances than I can describe to you where a CFO, being the kind of person that he or she is, wants to try and do it all, wants to, and thinks that they can, and they find themselves in a circumstance where they're the operational aspects of keeping up with the business, the issue we were talking about earlier, right? Keep your eye on the ball, ends up being impacted because they don't have enough bandwidth to handle that and to handle the acquisition activities. And being involved in an acquisition is very, very time intensive. So the best advice, or the tip of the day that I would share, if you find yourself in that circumstance, is be very realistic about looking at what your bandwidth really is, and make sure that you can handle it. And that may be reaching out to a group like yours, and getting help in that process. And you know, there clearly are, you know, wonderful organizations like Delaney that can be helpful and have experienced people on the bench that can plug right in. And that's probably a good investment as you go through that kind of a process.
Well, that's great. And Stuart, also, thank you for the plug. This has been an absolute pleasure, Stuart. I've certainly known you for many years, and you come with a tremendous book of business and success behind you. It really has been a pleasure, and I think you're going to have given our audience a very unique look at an M&A transaction. So thank you very much.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
We'd also like to thank our contributor, CFO Magazine, and to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to small to medium-sized businesses. For more information about Delaney, please go to DelaneyLLC.com. And thanks also go to Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website can be found at financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. We are actually doing a casting call. We are looking for CFOs. So if you are a CFO or know of a CFO that would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us via that website. Thank you for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.